to On the Edge with April Mahoney Brains. Here, this is the place where the conversation is pointed, the guests are sharp, and the responses are never dull. Welcome home, Brains.
Coming to you straight from San Diego, California, let's welcome our host, April Mahoney.
I am so excited to have you here with me on the edge, the place where the conversation is what pointed. Oh my God. The guests are super sharp and the responses are never dull. Brains, I have been waiting for this one here. I want you to hear this story. Okay, so you can sit back. I hope you have a snack because this is going to be better than a movie. Okay, this is incredible. This is incredible. And this man is so humble. You know, I don't know where his wings are. I don't see him on the back of that shirt, but he is really, really doing the most. He's going to talk about human durability, sustainability, resilience. You're not going to believe his story. This is Derek McManus from Australia. A former police officer. Let me make sure, because I took some notes. Let me make sure I get this right. He worked for Special Task and Rescue, which is like a form here in the US of our SWAT, but they do much more than that. Am I correct?
Correct, yeah.
He's got a harrowing story of survival. In addition to that, he is extremely philanthropic. He not only gives of his time, he gives of his money, he rides bicycles and supports people on tandem bicycles. He rides for children with cancer. I see him there laying on a bed giving plasma. We're gonna talk to him about all of that. He is one amazing guy. Welcome him to the edge right there. That is Derek McManus. How you doing, handsome?
I am doing sensational, thank you. Just sensational. I was just playing with my video settings. Can't quite get them right, so I get other things right. Can't quite get this video right, but really looking forward to this, April.
I've been looking forward to
it. I've listened to some of your interviews, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what you draw out of me this time.
Oh, my God. I'm waiting to hear the whole story. So let's begin at, I don't know, in the middle. Tell me a little bit about, you know, your work with the police force, and then tell them your harrowing story.
Okay, so I've been a policeman for 42 years. I retired only 18 months ago. And in that time, I worked all over the state, but I worked in the STAR Group. Now, STAR Group is Special Task and Rescue. Special Task and Rescue includes high-risk arrest, hostage siege, counter-terrorism, which is very similar to your SWAT teams. But we also do rescues, cliff rescue, cave rescue, mine rescue. I was also a diver, so going in and doing tactical diving as well as recovering dead bodies and evidence. And I was a sniper as well. So that's the sort of thing that we did. In fact, we did VIP security as well. So when the Queen came to visit Australia, I was part of the close quarter protection for the Queen. Now, the heroine story, as you say, is that one day we went out to arrest a guy. We were asked to arrest, and he was a high-risk arrest. So we knew there was a potential for something to go wrong. So we went to his house, and he made it very clear that he wasn't in the mood to be arrested that day. He started shooting. He fired 18 times with a high-powered Chinese military assault rifle. For those of you in America who do know rifles, it was an SKK 7.62. And he fired 18 times. He hit me 14 times with either bullets or shrapnel.
Wow. Brains, did you hear that? 14 times he was hit. But that's not all. Tell him the rest, Derek.
Okay. I love the way you build this up. I love it. Thank you.
I told you, it's better than the movie.
I had massive injuries to my body. So I had a severed artery in my left forearm. I had a severed artery in my right wrist. The femoral artery in my left thigh was missed by just the width of a piece of paper. One bullet went straight through my right Achilles tendon, took out about 80% of my Achilles tendon for about an inch and a half. And I was lying on the ground for 3 hours dealing with those injuries, but not just the injuries. I was dealing with my mind as well. So I was controlling my physical, my emotional, and my mental stability for the 3 hours I was lying on the ground. And I was fully conscious for 2 3/4 hours. And the last 15 minutes, I was passing in and out of consciousness because I just lost so much blood that there wasn't enough blood for my whole body to be operating. So I was starting to pass in and out of consciousness.
And when you woke up in the hospital, what did you say to yourself?
That's an interesting one because there were so many things that happened in that very first moment. But when I woke up in the hospital, it really was just a matter of, well, here I am. I knew I was going to be here. So, you know, what happens next? Come on, bring it on. Let's do it. Let's do this. And it really was that comfortable for me. Now, people say, how could you just be that comfortable having that massive amount of injury, lying on the ground? When my blood supply was draining down, I actually saw the white light. And I started wondering, is this what people talk about? I don't have a religious background, but I knew that this is what people talk about, the white light. I knew that death was very, very close. And then I was passing in and out of consciousness, and I was thinking to myself, what is life going to be like if I get out of this alive? So it was a very much an acknowledgement, I may not get out of this alive, but always looking at that possibility, yes, there is still a chance I will. So when I woke up in the hospital, it really was about just, okay, what do we do now? How do we manage this? Doctors, give me some advice. One of the things that I did prior to the shooting, which allowed me to just look at it so philosophically and pragmatically like that, was that I took a very good look at the choices that I was making, the possible consequences of those choices, and if they did occur, how am I going to be able to manage them? And what might the future look like if I do get out of it alive? And so I had a very clear conversation with my wife about the fact I may be shot and injured. And if I get injured, what's life going to look like? And if I die, what's life going to look like for her? Because it wasn't just about me. It was about her as well. And I had to make sure that she was well aware of what the consequences might be and what life might look like. But once we'd had that conversation, it was a very confronting conversation for both of us. But it was a very pragmatic conversation as well, because it gave us different tools, different attitudes, different approaches to what some other people might have. And so when I woke up in the hospital, it was like, well, I knew that it was a possibility of getting shot. I did get shot. I've survived. So, right, let's build life. What can I expect from here? And the doctors were telling me that I'll probably never walk properly again. I'll probably never be able to, in fact, you know, go back half a step. My wife was told that I shouldn't have survived the shooting. With the injuries I had, I should not have survived. She was told I was a 50-50 chance of surviving surgery. Once I survived surgery, I was a 50-50 chance of having major complications because of all the drugs that they had to use to fight all the infection from my... I had 2 bullets in my stomach, so the contents of my intestines had emptied into my bowel cavity, so sepsis had started to set in. And so they had to have some massive drugs. So there was a 50-50 chance of complication. And then I was told that I'll probably never walk properly again, never be able to go back to policing, rarely go back to sport. And there was a chance that, you know, I may not walk well enough that I might spend the rest of my life in a wheelchair. So that was the things the doctors were telling me. And, you know, I was very comfortable that if I'd ended up spending the rest of my life in a wheelchair, the decision I made to take the risks that I did were calculated. I knew what the consequences were. I consciously made that decision anyway. And it was now up to me to build the best life I could for the future. And okay, that was certainly going to be done on advice from other people as well.
All right. So let me interject here because that's what I do. Okay.
Yeah,
I do 100 with my brains. You said you don't have a religious background.
Yeah.
Religious has nothing to do with spirituality because you saw the light. Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There was a light at the end of the tunnel, and by God's grace, it wasn't a train. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, you survived that. But you didn't survive your marriage.
No. Now, my marriage broke up 2 years after the shooting. And it was direct result of the shooting, but it wasn't caused by the shooting itself. So my marriage prior to the shooting was not something that I was actually happy with at that point. But my parents had always taught me, and my parents had a religious background, and they had always taught me, one life, one love, one marriage. And I was trying to live to that as best I could, because I wanted to honor my parents.
Right. And the reason why I bring that up is because that's traumatizing. You know, you got up and she had packed your lunch and kissed you on the cheek and said, "Hey, I'll see you when you get home." And life was never the same.
No.
We had a pre-conversation, a long conversation.
Absolutely.
And we talked about post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
You said that you don't have any of that.
No.
I can't say, you know, one way or another. I don't know how in the hell you don't. Okay. I have a PTSD just thinking about what you went through. You know, it was a situation. Let me tell you this little story real quick.
Yeah, please.
Where I worked on the military base.
Yep.
And there was a young gentleman that had come in there, and he had just came back from Iraq, and he had a PTSD episode. He started sweating. He started trembling. He was hearing things. He was seeing things. He was right back at that place in Iraq on that tank when that IUD went off. He was right back there again. And I was seeing his whole body change, his whole temperament. And I'm going to be honest with you, brains. I was working in the cosmetics department. I locked myself in the closet. I didn't know if he had a gun. I didn't know what happened, but he was there. How can you not honestly say that you are not still traumatized from that? Derek?
I like to describe it that I prepared myself very realistically for what I realized I could expect in my future. And I prepared myself physically, I prepared myself mentally, and mentally is the intellectual, knowing all the policies, procedures, practices, first aid, all those sorts of things. But I prepared myself emotionally as well. And I took a look at what I'd dealt with in my past, because I've had other incidents where people have tried to shoot me. And we've been in a wrestling match when they've pulled out a gun, and I've actually put my thumb between the hammer and the gun to stop the gun being fired. And I took a look at what did I do in that situation? How did I handle that physically, mentally, and emotionally? What was running through my mind? How can I do that better? What can I learn? What could I improve upon? What did I do, not so well? And I took a very realistic look at what I could expect by making that choice, and I prepared myself for it. The other thing that I did was once I got into hospital, within 5 days of being in hospital, threw my hand in the air and said, "Get me a psych. I want to talk to a psych." Now, this wasn't about me thinking I'm weak, I'm in need of psych help, or I'm going around the bend, I'm twisted, whatever. This was me about doing the human durability thing again, of saying, I know where I am now. I know there are consequences from these sorts of things, PTSD, nightmares, flashbacks, hot sweats, as you've just described. I know they're just normal things that other people have gone through. So I wanted to pick the brain of the psychiatrist and say, how have people dealt with these things badly? How have people dealt with these things well? What can I expect? And how can I best manage it? I had one meeting with that psychiatrist, and he was one of the best trauma psychiatrists in Australia. I was very, very fortunate. We had a 3-hour meeting, and we were backwards and forwards. Derek, what are you thinking? Okay, what should I think here? What can I anticipate? Okay, if I anticipate that's going to happen, this is how I see that playing out. And if that does happen, this is how I'll be able to manage it. We had one 3-hour meeting, and he said, "Derek, you can go back to work psychologically tomorrow. You have no PTSD, you have no anxiety, no stress." And he also said that I never needed to come back and see him again unless I felt I wanted to.
Wow.
Everybody, including myself, I was expecting to be in therapy for, people were expecting me to be in therapy for decades. I expected to be in therapy for an extended period of time, whatever that might be. And but when he said, I don't need to come back.
See, that expectation and realization are two totally different things. I mean, and I'm not discrediting what you're going through. I commend you. 110%. You know, I was attacked by my own dog when I was pregnant, and I'm still traumatized.
Absolutely.
And I still love dogs, but I still feel it, and I know what's happening. All right, so let's switch it up a little bit. I want to talk to you a little bit about policing, because right now here in the United States,
yeah,
we are in the midst of the trial of the officer that put his knee on the neck of Mr. George Floyd.
Let me just be very clear. What happened there is not something that I would have done myself, and I wonder why and all those things. It doesn't make sense to me, but I need to wait for a verdict.
Okay, well, I don't need to wait for a verdict. My eyes and my heart tell me, because I'm a Black woman in America.
Yeah.
Or a white man in Australia, okay?
Yeah.
So our life experiences, and you on the other side of the law, my husband works in law enforcement. So I understand where he's coming from. So I understand that when you call a police officer, you're not calling him for milk and cookies.
No.
You're calling him because you are trying to get a resolution, trying to be protected. All that you see is death and destruction. I mean, you're not building, you know, unless it's volunteer work or the community work that you're doing, you're not building houses. You are there to bring the peace. You are there to be a peace officer.
Correct.
No matter what. Okay. So now, a couple things. Lives matter, Black, white, whatever.
Yes.
But we're being used as targets here in America, and it's been this way forever. So as a result of that, Americans are saying, hey, defund the police department, which I don't think is a very smart move, because again, when something goes down, who you gonna call? Ghostbusters? need someone. But these individuals also need a break. I think there should be term limits for police officers, because again, there's a psyche. There's somebody's gonna go ticky ticky boom. Maybe not you. You are one of the few. Because you even went back to, after all this, you even went back to work.
Absolutely. I went back fully operational to all the jobs that I was doing before.
So my questions to you is, number one, what do you think about defunding of the police? What's your position on that?
Just crazy. Just crazy. It may be an option for the future. You can't rule that out. But you need something solid in place to be able to replace it. This idea of just going to the community and the community looking after each other, is there anything in history where that has happened? In the history since police departments have been started, the police departments have worked well. Yes, there's been some corruption in the police departments. Yes, there's been some people who do the wrong thing in police departments, but it's no different to the rest of society. We have corruption in the rest of society. We have people who do the wrong thing in the rest of society. We need to find a way to make our police more accountable. There's no two ways about that. I've been very fortunate in my career that I have not been exposed to a lot of corruption. And where I have, I've been able to speak about it and have something done about it. But the police department system, I believe, works well. But maybe if there was a more solid educational background, pay is not the answer.
Because a police officer is there for policing. If someone has mental health, they need to have the support of a mental health expert to go
absolutely
out.
Absolutely. Police come in a crisis, and we only deal with the crisis part of it. We bring the crisis down, and then if this person needs mental health, we will make sure that they get mental health assistance, right? If we believe they need social work, we will get social work. If we believe they need legal advice, we will get legal advice. We are just crisis.
Right.
The other side of policing, I'm just going to go back a little bit, is that we see a whole heap of trauma. We get called in crisis when things are going wrong, and we get to arrest people. And if we look at that side where we are just arresting people, it's all horrific. But if we take a look at the other side where we are providing a solution for a victim, and we see the relief in the victim's life as a result of the reaction we've taken, we can go, wow, that's actually something decent that's happening in my life. Right. I can improve the life of that person as a result of the action I'm taking. Now, this is maybe something that's different about me. I've done several different character tests, and one of the top character strengths is gratitude. And I think that makes a big difference in perspective on how you perceive things, you know, how you interpret the world around you. I am very grateful for many, many things around me. And I have come through 42 years of policing and still love it. Still loved it till the day I left. And I've come out without PTSD, stress, or anything else.
And I mean, and that's amazing. That's amazing. Let me ask you something else that's different probably in Australia than America. What's your gun laws for private citizens there?
Ours are much, much
I mean, are you able just to go to a gun show and get that high-powered weapon?
No.
Are you able to have magazines that hold infinite amount of bullets?
No.
Are you able to, have your guns so that they go and an 18-year-old or 19-year-old or 15-year-old goes and shoots up everybody in the cotton-picking middle school? What's your gun laws?
Okay, so our gun laws are very, very strict. To purchase a weapon, you have to go to the shop, assess the weapon you want to buy, then take all the details of the weapon, and then submit a report to the police to get permission to purchase that weapon. And then you take that back and you go to the shop and you purchase your weapon. So you can't just go in and go, I feel like buying a gun because I'm angry. There's a process to go through. So that's a diffuser there. All weapons have to be stored in locked cabinets. The ammunition has to be stored separately to the rifle. The bolt or the action of the weapon has to be stored separately to the weapon itself. We are not allowed to travel around in our cars with our weapons. If we own a pistol, that is only to be used either for legal purposes as a security guard, or you're only allowed to possess it when you're traveling to or from a licensed gun club or a licensed competition or some other valid reason for carrying it. And they too have to be always under lock and key. You can't have them in a glass cabinet displayed. So our gun laws are very, very different here to America. And the maximum magazine we're allowed to have is a 5-round magazine. And we are not allowed semi-automatic weapons. We can use bolt action, we can use lever action, all those sorts of things, but we're not allowed to have a semi-automatic weapon.
So how did they get the semi-automatic weapon that let loose on you?
This was before we changed the gun laws. My shooting was back in 1994. We had another horrific shooting down in Tasmania, and there were 33 people killed, and that was in 1996. 2 years after my shooting. And it was after that incident in Tasmania that the gun laws changed. And we actually the government bought back all of the semi-automatic weapons that we could and got them completely off the street.
Let me ask a question, because this broke my heart flying over Tasmania on my way to Australia, this isolated little island where, a lot of Aborigines people are there. A lot of prisoners are there.
They were there. There's actually very, very few there now. They were there and they were treated horrendously.
Yeah.
Horrendously.
Yeah. I felt the energy as I flew over. You know how you can watch the tracking device?
Yeah.
Qantas Airlines. Shout out to Qantas Airlines. They were good to me. But there was something that my heart just really started to beat and my mouth started to get really dry. It was an energy there. So now, let's fast forward to something a little bit more pleasant. You have done incredible work, 42 years as a police officer, working in all of these undercover and secret service. You survived this horrific, life-changing event. And now you have dedicated your life to helping others, helping young children with cancer, doing bike rides, and also giving plasma. Tell us about that.
Okay, so volunteering to help people has always been a big part of my life. In fact, I, at the age of about 22 or 23, I won a Young Citizen of the Year award for my local community because I was running a gymnastics club. I didn't have children of my own. The gymnastics club needed a coach and I just threw my hand in there and said, hey, listen, I can help out. I ended up being the head coach and running it. So that's where my volunteering kind of started. And since then, it's just been something that I've always been part of. Currently, I've just resigned from a white ribbon committee, where that white ribbon committee, we would run the largest breakfast in Australia, 1,300 people seated for breakfast to talk about domestic violence and how we can reduce that. So I was on that committee for about 10 years. I work with Down syndrome people, and I'm teaching them how to speak as in public speaking. And it's basically just giving them the confidence that their voice is nice to be listened to, that they have something valid to say. I volunteer for Motor Neuron. I've done a couple of charity things for them. And you're referring to, at the moment, that I've just finished a charity bike ride for Canteen. Canteen is working with teenagers who have been affected by children, by cancer. Maybe not the teenager themselves, but maybe a sibling, maybe a parent. One of the girls that I met on this ride, she had lost both of her parents to cancer by the age of about 19. And she was on her own after that.
It was a 600-mile ride. Who does that?
In a week. It was over a week. It was a long time. We had a group of 37 of us doing it. So it wasn't just me. There was 36 other people that did that ride as well. And it was just amazing. We had leaders to help us and guide us. We had support vehicles supplying us with food and drink every time we needed it. It was really well supported. And it was great fun, believe it or not, great fun.
Well, I believe it was fun, but it was also, it was a rite of passage. It was, another door. It was another opening, another door.
Yeah.
And so you've done that. And in addition to that, now giving plasma.
Yes.
You know, I want you to share with my brains the importance of that. Because, again, you know, I can only bring up culture so many times. But in the Black community, that's not something that we do, per se. Not that we don't give blood.
No.
But I don't remember the last time I saw a blood drive. I don't remember the last time I saw African Americans in my community, Los Angeles, and the circles that I travel, really go out for bone marrow testing, for bone marrow transplants. I don't see a lot of us doing organ donations. I'm telling you, it's hard to get folks to even take the vaccine, but it's because we have been disrespected and used as lab rats for centuries. This is nothing new. Hesitance there. But what I try to share with my community is that if you are not a part of the solution, you are part of the problem. And
it's a hard thing to get your head around, to move from one mentality to the other.
And I'm one of those people that I'm not really down for receiving blood. You know, there's other things that they can do if they can, but you lost so much blood. You understand the value of it. So tell me a little bit about your experience and why do you do that?
Well, I actually grew up with a needle phobia. If I saw a needle on TV, I would get shivers and sweats and all that sort of stuff. So I absolutely hated needles. But I saw the value in blood donation. And in Australia here, we don't get paid for our blood donation. We volunteer our time. You know, we get looked after with lollies and sweets and drinks and all those sorts of things.
What are lollies? Lollipops?
Candy. Candy.
That's sweet. Yeah. Lollies. I like that.
Lollies, candy. Yeah. I have an English background. I'm a Scotsman by birth.
Oh, okay.
But I saw the value in it, and I pushed myself through my phobia of needles to be able to donate blood. And I donated once prior to getting shot. And it was only just probably 6 months, 8 months before I got shot that I pushed myself. And then when I got shot, I lost so much blood that my body was completely closing down. Body holds 10 units of blood, and I had lost 8 units. The doctor said that I was down to my last 2 units of blood. When he first saw me, there was no color in my body because there wasn't enough blood to give it pigment color. I wasn't breathing, I wasn't moving, and I wasn't making any sound. And he thought I was already dead because I'd lost so much blood. But he described it that I took a last gasp of breath, and he thought he'd work his magic, and he did. Absolute legend. And just a little aside from the blood donation part of it, that doctor and his team and my star group mates stood in direct line of fire for 10 minutes bullets whizzing around their ears so that they could stabilize me. And during this 10 minutes is when they pumped blood into me. And in the next 7 hours between extraction and the end of surgery, I had used 24 units of blood or blood product. Body holds 10. Mm. I'd used 24 in 7 hours. Wow. And that just sealed it for me. The value of blood donation for me was one, it was life or death. No two ways about it. My body had been flushed through a couple of times. I'd used that much blood. So the fact that I made one donation beforehand, fought that phobia, that really gave me a greater satisfaction that I was worthy of receiving it. Because if I'd received it without donating it, I think I would have felt a bit more guilty. And when I donate now, it would be almost a guilt factor donation. Right. But I was donating before and I continue to donate now. In South Australia, I became the inaugural ambassador for the blood service, another volunteering role that I did. Just to promote the value of blood donation, because it is
invaluable. Here in the United States, you can be a heroin addict and stand in line and get $35 for a pint of blood.
Yeah.
You can be, you know, and shout out to heroin addicts. I'm not judging you. I'm just saying. But the lifestyle that people live, my sister-in-law, unfortunately, got a blood transfusion, ended up with Hep C. So, yep. Yeah, so it's a lot involved in that. But again, people still need blood.
Absolutely. You know, if you're desperate for it, if you're desperate for it and you need it and it's a life or death. And I can't, that's one of the things that ran through my mind after I received 24 units. Even if I did contain, contract, that's the word I was looking for. Even if I did contract Hep C or something like that, I'm still alive at that time. I would have been dead otherwise. Now, I don't know what your sister's situation was, and I'm not trying to...
She was thrown from a horse. She was thrown from a horse, and her spleen erupted, and we had to wave down a helicopter.
Yeah.
Again, you know, they did what they had to do, but again, it was bad blood. And so there's a lot. So, you know, I've given blood, I think twice, but one of the times was to myself because I was going to have surgery and I told to take my own blood because I was apprehensive about taking some stranger's blood, but
absolutely,
you know what, it's difficult. It's a difficult decision and people have to figure it out for themselves. I encourage people because it's very, very important. You know, we hear all the time that the blood banks are low, especially in the midst of a disaster.
Absolutely. Now, the other side of it is that it's not just people who are in the midst of a disaster or car prangs or horse accidents or whatever. We've got hemophiliacs who just need blood continuously. We have people with blood diseases that need blood continuously. Mothers giving birth to babies, they need blood continuously because of all the things. There are so many different uses other than just in an emergency. And so I encourage everybody, absolutely everybody who is able to go out and donate blood. It's. I mean, you get paid for it there. We volunteer our time here. And there are people lining up to donate blood. We still need more blood donors.
Exactly.
Because it regenerates within 3 days. 3 days, your blood volume is back up to full and you're back full steam ahead. And with plasma, you can donate it another 14 days later. With blood, you have to wait an extended period of time.
Now, I thought I saw you. Are you donating plasma?
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
It depends on what our blood service needs. Sometimes they ask me to donate plasma. Sometimes they ask me to donate blood.
Tell us the difference.
Okay. So plasma is where they take the blood from you. They spin the blood and they get the plasma and separate it out of the blood. And then they put the red blood cells back into your body. And then you can donate once every 2 weeks. If they just take the full blood out from you, then you have to wait 3 months to be able to donate full blood again. But they use it for different purposes. The plasma can be separated out and it makes different sort of antibodies and they use it for different things. And the full blood, the whole blood, is used for maybe women going through pregnancy, people like me who have lost so much blood. But the blood products can be separated into 18 different ways that the blood products can be used. And plasma is something that they need lots and lots of. Mm. So if they return the red blood cells to you and you can donate plasma every 14 days, instead of donating blood once every 3 months, they get a lot more use out of it.
Well, we could talk forever, but I don't want to miss this. Tell me about human durability. What in the world are, what else do you have on your plate? What are you doing now? You're doing a coaching program, and that so is high performance people.
Absolutely.
You know, so many things. High performance mental health.
Absolutely.
Check me in, Dr. Derek.
And it is, it's high performance people with high performance mental health. And it's reflecting on what I did in my training to be able to get into Star Group, how I managed the shooting, how I went and spoke to the psychiatrist. And he said, Derek, you're fine. You don't need to come back and see me unless you want to. And it's about living a full life. And it really is about having more confidence with less stress. And that's as simple as it is. More confidence with less stress. And there is a formula for it. And it will work for anybody. And it really will, I believe. I believe it so much that I've got the University of South Australia School of Psychology. They are helping me with research. They see this as different to just resilience. Resilience is the ability to bounce back. Human durability is the ability to sustain an optimal performance, no matter what the challenge is. And there's several different models that I work with, but it really is just a mindset and a vulnerability of saying, I'm not perfect. There is a growth process that I go through to get to the point where I know that I am reliable, 100% reliable. So we start with fragility. Whenever we start something brand new, you know, if you don't know what you're doing, if you're a new sport, a new relationship, a new job, you get promoted, there's a little bit of fragility there where you know you've got a lot of learning to do, right? And we sometimes make mistakes. We're enthusiastic, but we need to be able to experiment and gain some experience. But where we want to get to, most people, is the middle of it. We start at fragility, we want to get to the middle, and that's resilience. Resilience is the ability to bounce back. And most people go, if I'm resilient, that's good, because if something goes wrong, I can fix it. Now, that's a very powerful place to be. There's no two ways about it. But we don't want to be fixing problems all the time.
Right.
So I say resilience is in the middle, fragility, resilience, and then durability. Right. Durability is where we know that we are 100% reliable at the level of performance we are at that time. Okay. To give you an example of durability being just that place of comfort. And I've now realized that durability is a comfort zone. This is where you know your performance is 100% reliable. This is when you go into a situation and you don't go, oh my gosh, how's this going to work? What am I going to have to fix? You go into a situation, you go, I've got this. This is going to be a great day. I know what I'm doing. I feel so confident. And it is, it's your comfort zone because you know you can perform. Now, there was a chemical explosion in Beirut, in the port of Beirut in Lebanon. And the government and all the news reporters were saying that the Lebanese people are resilient. They'll be able to bounce back from this. It was massive. It was 3,000 tons of chemical that exploded, massive damage. And they were saying, you know, the people will be resilient. They'll be able to bounce back. There was one lady from that town, from Beirut, that was interviewed. And she said, I'm tired of being resilient. I just want to be able to enjoy my life.
Wow.
And this is that point of durability where you're in your comfort zone. And you go, I've got this. I feel comfortable. I can perform. I know I'm going to do well. And this relates to raising your children, playing sport, going for a ride on your bike, relating to someone else, having difficult conversations. If you're in your comfort zone, there is no stress because you're in your comfort zone. But right. Once you get to that comfort zone, I call that your baseline. Now,
right.
I make a very clear distinction. People talk about when things go wrong, let's go back to basics. It's a very common saying. Let's go back to basics. Let's start all over again and build it back up. Going back to basics, if this is the human durability and this is the baseline, basics is way down here.
Right.
It's where you start your job. It's the first day
you're already behind the eight ball. You're already, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. We are all performing way above basics most of the time. So if you take this leap, once you get to your comfort zone, you go, I've got this. This feels really comfortable. I'm enjoying this. Okay, what's my next challenge? Right. Once you get to that and you've got your comfort zone, you go, where's my next challenge? You take another leap. Now, if that leap crashes and burns, you don't want to burn back to basics. You want to come back to your baseline. You want to come back to where you know your performance is 100% reliable. Now, this Brené Brown talks about vulnerability. This is about being vulnerable enough to say, I've made a mistake. Let me identify where it sits. Where is that mistake? What do I need to do? One of the beautiful things I've designed into this continuum of durability is that the movement from fragility to resilience comes with coaching, guidance, mentoring, and experimentation. And you have to have people around you that allow you to experiment. Because in those early stages, it's that experimentation. Let me try it this way. Let me try it that way. Oh, that's not quite working. Let me build up. Give me some more guidance. Give me some more coaching. Oh, okay, that's how I do it. And then you get to the point where you've done it so many times, you go, okay, I know what the solution to that is. I know I've made that mistake. I can fix that one. And now you're starting to become resilient. And you know you're resilient when other people are coming to you and they're going, hey, April, how do I fix this? What do I do? You've done this before. Tell me. You go, oh, okay. I've gained some credibility. I can solve problems. But like the lady in Beirut, we don't want to be solving problems all the time. We don't want to be resilient. We don't want to be bouncing back.
Right.
We want to get to that point where we know we can perform and we can enjoy our day, because we're not going to be smashed with problems all the time.
We want to be accountable. We want to be responsible. We want to identify with what it is, because none of us are perfect.
No, absolutely.
We all make a mistake, you know. I'm writing my next book, and my next book is 365 days. And I have been charting what I learned and how it applies, good, bad, or indifferent, for 365 days. So accountability, and I love how you say, you know, fragility and resilience and durability, all of those is definitely a recipe for success. I want people to work with you. I just love having a conversation with you, bantering back and forth, because again, it's, you know, that's, I think, one of the biggest challenges that the world faces today, is allowing people space, is allowing them to like or dislike. Allow them that space. Everybody doesn't have to like everything, but don't bother me. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, that's right.
And respect the men and women that put their life on the line every single day. You know, if they are writing tickets, or if they are rappelling out of airplanes, or if they are going into Secret Service covert operations, these people have, it's a different kind of person. It's like a doctor or a nurse. You've dedicated your life. And I'm so proud to say that I know you. I'm so happy that you are here. And I'm happy that you saw the light, because you know that there is something there. It wasn't the end. I'll tell you something really quick that someone told me. Dr. Cornel West, a prolific, profound African-American professor at Princeton, Harvard, who's been at Yale, everywhere. And he said, you know, April, he said, the world is cruel and foul when you are brought in between a place of urination and defecation and a puddle of blood and slime. And you're forced out. But on the other side of that, there's somebody to catch you. There's a bright light. There's someone to welcome you and love you and honor you. So it is, it's a lot of work. And it is about human durability. And it is about sustainability. And just when we do pass, you know, a lot of people pass in their sleep. But you're just going through a portal. You're just going through another change. And so what I encourage all of you to do, brains, is to really look at that. Look at your life. Take responsibility. Take a chance. And be like Derek. Well, I want to call you Gary.
Gary's my best mate. You interviewed him a little while ago.
And be like Derek. Never give up. Never give up. Thank you so much for being here with me on The Edge. I'm full. This has been one heavy duty conversation, and I love it. And I love you even more. I give you a virtual hug. I'll take it, all that. Tell my brains to get in contact with you if they want to work with you. Have you written a book? And if not, why not?
I have started writing a book. I've definitely started writing a book. Why not? To be quite honest, when this happened to me, I actually didn't see it as big as what other people do. Because of my perspective prior to the shooting, my overall view of this was, I went to work, I got shot, I fell down, I got up, I got better, I went back to work. Isn't that what everybody else would do? it's now that I'm starting to delve into the mindset more and coming up with these human durability type perspectives that I'm realizing there's more to it. And so the book is, the book of the story is the first one I'm going to write. And then it's the book of human durability, that process.
Well, it's
the book of human durability that I'm looking forward to more than writing the book of the story. Everybody wants a book of the story. I'm looking forward to the book of the process that can help other people to get to what I did.
I think it'll be a beautiful blend of whatever. And I love to hear it in audio. You have a wonderful voice inflection. And I mean, no one can really read it the way that they can hear it, you know, audibly. So thank you so much. Again, website, what's your information?
Website, derekmcmanus.com. And certainly if you get to that website, you'll have all my contact details, my email, my phone number. I work face-to-face and I love working face-to-face, but I work virtually as well. And I've done many workshops with people in Southeast Asia, New Zealand. So virtual as well. Anybody, anywhere, love to work with you.
And I'd love for you to work with them. All right. My last question for you.
Yeah.
You had three wishes.
Oh, wow. Maybe. My three wishes. It goes back to what I want out of delivering this program. I just want to see people have more confidence and less stress. And for me, it would be gaining more wisdom. We all have a depth of wisdom. I would like more wisdom.
Wow. Well, you are one wise man. Yes, you are. And I thank you again. Brains, go back and listen to other edgy conversations here on The Edge. I tell you all the time, I need you to subscribe, okay, to YouTube, to LinkedIn, to Facebook, all of those great places, because I've got some heavy hitters, people that have dedicated their life, their total existence, their purpose, just to, you know, be able to share that with you. And I thank you so much for being here on The Edge with me and my brains. Come back and join us. Know that you are always welcome here. There's always a place for you. And there's no need in me telling you to be careful, because careful is you. And you're the man. Thank you so much. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much. And know that your future podcasts, I'll be listening.
All right. Thank you.
Love them. Love them. Thank you so much, April. Absolute honor to be interviewed by you.
Oh, you're a sweetheart.